The following podcast contains advertising. To access an ad-free version of the Lawfare podcast, become a material supporter of Lawfare at patreon.com/lawfare. That's patreon.com/lawfare. Also, check out Lawfare's other podcast offerings, Rational Security, Chatter, Lawfare No Bull, and The Aftermath.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
You would expect that their political project would have been utterly discredited in 2009 because of their defeat. They didn't even own territory, but it's at that point where it became the most popular, and jihadists were the most energized to see it happen. And I anticipate you will see something similar in the short, if they completely lose their rebel governments in Iraq and Syria and a little bit in Libya, they lose it. I anticipate that the jihadist community will be doubly energized to try and bring it back in the short term. They have persuaded their followers that territory is everything, and they've delivered the goods. So it has to cost them then when they lose that territory. They will explain it away, but there will be a cost. But what I'm arguing is that it will not be fatal in the short term. It will only energize their followers. That loss will have to be enduring for it to really discredit their political program.
I'm Quinta Jurecic, and this is the Lawfare Podcast, July 16th, 2016. That was Will McCants, a senior fellow at Brookings and the director of the Project on U.S. Relations with the Islamic World. Will came on the podcast to discuss ISIS's involvement in the recent spate of terrorist attacks across the globe. To what extent has ISIS really been involved in these attacks? How does their involvement reflect a change in strategy or a response to recent territorial losses? And how does a group that presents itself as a caliphate continue to exist without controlling any land? It's the Lawfare Podcast, episode 179, Will McCants on A Caliphate Without a Caliphate.
So let's start out by talking about what ISIS has been up to over the last few weeks. We've a bunch of spectacular attacks all over the world. Which ones are they clearly involved in, and which ones are they kind of nebulously involved in, and which ones are they innocent of?
Right. Some of the ones that they seem to be most clearly involved with are the ones that they're being quiet about for various reasons. The bombing in Turkey seems to be pretty clearly an ISIS-directed attack. The bombings in Saudi Arabia, particularly the one in Mecca, which I still think they haven't claimed, was an ISIS guy. The others that they are happy to claim are ones that they either just inspired or was part of their loose network, so the Orlando attack or the attack in Dhaka in Bangladesh. And I think this speaks to the different audiences that they are trying to influence with these attacks.
So what's in it for ISIS to bomb something and then not take credit for it? Why would you do that?
Well, one reason could be that you hope the blame will be pinned on someone else, or at least you want to create confusion about who did it. And in Turkey, it seems that they want blame to settle on the Kurds, or at least there to be some sort of uproar, because they're trying to press on that ethnic fault line inside of Turkey.
But what's the value of a terrorist attack that gets pinned on somebody else for ISIS? I mean, is the theory that the Turks will actually believe it was the PKK, or is the theory that you get some strategic benefit from the attack, but you don't want the costs of Turkey turning its wrath on you?
It could be one or the other, but certainly the more that Turkey is distracted with a war against the PKK, the more that it benefits ISIS, and the more it takes attention off of what they're doing in eastern Syria.
Okay, so the conventional wisdom is ISIS is turning to conventional spectacular bombings, terrorist attacks, because they're losing land. Do you buy it?
I do. That's an argument I've put forward, so I have to buy it. I'm deeply invested now. So I have to sink further costs. But there's, to be honest, three competing theories, I think, at least. And they're all plausible, given the absence of evidence about the organization's internal thinking.
Okay, so let's go through those three.
Right. So the first one that I subscribe to is that this is tied to a loss of territory. The theory goes that the more territory they lose, the more constrained they feel in their homeland in Syria and Iraq, the more they are lashing out at their enemies as a way to punish them or to deter them or simply to distract them and cause them to turn their attention elsewhere. And the support for this theory is that since the United States and the coalition began bombing in August of 2014, they began to build a terror network abroad. They began to call for attacks abroad systematically. And then they began to carry out those attacks. And the attacks have only grown more intense over time, the longer that they've lost territory. There's another competing theory that goes that this is not so much about a loss of territory as it is about things that global jihadists do. And the only reason that ISIS didn't do it before is because it didn't have the capability. It wasn't a lack of intent, it was a lack of capability. And they had the capability after the summer of 2014 when they conquered Mosul, declared their caliphate. They finally had enough resources, enough manpower where they could start building out and expanding. And so the call for attacks abroad or the direction of attacks abroad would be explained as, you know what, this is something that jihadists, global jihadists, always want to do, and now this group actually had the capability to do it, so they're making good on it. The third explanation is that this has to do with rivalry between the Islamic State and al-Qaeda. They are competing for resources, human resources, financial resources. They want to convince members of the global jihadist movement that they should throw their support behind their particular organization, not the other guys. The timing of the bombings and the call for attacks can also be explained under this rubric by pointing to the fact that ISIS used to be part of al-Qaeda until the spring of 2014. Once they split, then the competition begins in earnest. So the call for attacks in September and the building of the international terror network could be explained under this rationale as well. Now, this particular rationale doesn't necessarily have to stand alone as an explanation. You can fit it under the others, if you wish. You could see competition as being a part of either strategy.
So are number one and two really incompatible with one another? I mean, couldn't you argue, hey, they achieved the ability to do this stuff, so they started doing it, and then they started losing territory, and it really put a premium on that aspect of the operation. And so, you know, they kind of went full steam ahead with the global terrorism stuff, whereas before it had been, you know, not something that they weren't thinking about or planning to do. But, you know, when you're kind of busy building the caliphate, you got to keep your priorities straight.
Definitely. And that's how I've split the difference. I see this as a matter of priorities, and that early on, ISIS's top priority, not only priority, but top priority, was building the caliphate at home. But they always had the caliphate first. But they always had the intent of carrying out attacks abroad. It's just that when the coalition began to attack, the priorities shifted and survival became much more important, and they saw a global strategy as a part of a strategy for surviving at home.
So I'm interested in the problem of a caliphate without land. What makes it possible to declare the caliphate is that you have something really conceptually approaching sovereignty over a discernible piece of territory. You claim, obviously, lands far beyond it, but your authority within particular territorial space is not subject to actual challenge from anybody else. And then all of a sudden, that territory gets smaller and smaller and smaller, and reminds me a little bit of, you know, Yertle the Turtle, right? How important is land? You know, what happens if you declared a caliphate and nobody came? How important is the land to the project?
Right. Can you have a caliphate without the caliphate? So I think it's instructive to look back to the previous decade when they first declared themselves as the Islamic State. And they declared it without having any actual state to speak of. They didn't really control any territory. They certainly didn't impose taxes or Islamic law. And they were widely ridiculed because of it. They were beaten as an insurgency by 2009. Even though they remained a powerful terror organization, they had to operate clandestinely. So they were beaten as an insurgency. But it's in 2009 when their fans around the world really began to literally take up their banner and to start engaging in state-building enterprises in other lands as part of the project of restoring the caliphate. And so they were able to keep hope alive, and the more countries that fell into chaos, the more security vacuums that opened up, the more places ISIS's fans were able to try and implement their political program, until ISIS itself had another bite at the apple in 2012 and 2013. So the point is, you would expect that their political project would have been utterly discredited in 2009 because of their defeat. They didn't even own territory, but it's at that point where it became the most popular, and jihadists were the most energized to see it happen. And I anticipate you will see something similar in the short term. If they completely lose their rebel governments in Iraq and Syria and a little bit in Libya, if they lose it, I anticipate that the jihadist community will be doubly energized to try and bring it back in the short term. And ISIS itself has recognized this. There's a propaganda statement they put out recently where they try to prepare their followers for the eventual loss of territory and say that we will make a comeback, and the only way we don't make a comeback is if we lose this territory for a generation and people forget what we've done.
So that's really interesting. That suggests that it's win-win for them. If you win territory, then you're badass because you've won territory and declared a caliphate, and you get points for that. But if you lose, then you achieve popularity as a result of having lost.
Right, at least in the short term. And they can point to their prior experience with good reason to show that that's the case. In the long term, if they lose, they are also right that the political project looks less convincing as a project because they were never able to make good on it again. But the challenge is they've just got so many more places to go in the Middle East and North Africa to give it a try.
So how much does land and the caliphate change that? I mean, they made such a drama out of being the caliphate. It's not just the Islamic State.
Right.
It's not just, you know, we have some land and we're, you know, making an Islamic emirate here. It's not, I mean, it's endowed with this intense religious significance. And then the caliph turns out to be, militarily speaking, a loser.
Right.
And how much is that like, you know, Donald Trump then not winning? doesn't the caliph have to be a winner?
Yes, and it will certainly badly damage their legitimacy. I think you're right in the sense that they have persuaded their followers that territory is everything, and they've delivered the goods. So it has to cost them then when they lose that territory. They will explain it away, but there will be a cost. But what I'm arguing is that it will not be fatal in the short term. It will only energize their followers. That loss will have to be enduring for it to really discredit their political program.
And what happens, I assume, if we agree that the growth of external facing terrorism among the ISIS people is a function of territorial loss, we can expect that to magnify in the face of territorial defeat?
That's right. That's right, because they are very incentivized to carry out more attacks for revenge, for punishment, but also to create the conditions of bringing their state back.
Although they're not going to bring it back in Istanbul or Paris or Belgium, right? I mean, what is the value to their state of those sort of external attacks? Is it just a, hey, anything Al-Qaeda can do, we can do better sort of thing?
That's what I think. This is where I think the resource competition argument makes a lot of sense, because they are looking for new recruits, they're looking for new money. You have to stay in the public eye as a consequence, and international attacks, high-profile attacks, do that for them.
So how has their vocabulary changed as they've moved into this period of decline? I mean, you know, there was a kind of bombastic, we're ISIS, you're not rhetoric for a couple years as they were seizing territory. What do they sound like now?
Defiant, utterly defiant. They say that we may lose. Losing is a real possibility. We may once again be in the desert as we were in the preceding decade. But we have done it. We have demonstrated to the Muslim world that this is possible, that we don't need to wait for a far-off future. We don't need to build a popular front. We don't need to listen to the opinions of anyone. We don't need massive armaments. We've demonstrated how this can be done, and we've made good on it.
And is that, an argument with a receptive audience at this point, or is it? I forget which government official said that they'd seen a notable downturn in ISIS-inspired recruitment in the United States. Hey, we're losing, come join us. In American campaigns, that doesn't work real well. We may lose. We'll go back to the drawing board and try to get nominated again. You know, send $10.
Well, this is why it's a message that is directed at the jihadists in particular. This is an argument they're having with Al-Qaeda. What is the meaning of what we've done? What is the lasting lesson of what we've done?
And so describe for me both what the ISIS version of the of that narrative is and what the Al-Qaeda version of that narrative is. What's the sort of internal jihadi to jihadi debate here?
It all revolves around the question of how much popular support do you need to be politically successful, in success being establishing Islamic states. From Al-Qaeda's perspective, you need broad-based support in the Muslim world to achieve your political objectives. Therefore, you have to make allies, even with people theologically you don't agree with. The best example of this on the ground is the Nusra Front, Al-Qaeda's affiliate inside of Syria, which has embedded itself in the insurgency and has been an acceptable member of the insurgency to many of the Sunni rebels inside of Syria. As a consequence, their argument is going to be, hey, we've been able to stick around, you guys are gone, we're going to succeed in shaping the nature of the future Syrian state, it's going to have an Islamic character, and we did that because we stayed and we fought alongside the people and didn't dictate terms. ISIS is going to argue that, look, your revolution is going to be stolen from you. You're not going to get the state that you want. It's going to be a weak state. It's not going to be a true Islamic state. Your followers may be satisfied with it, but any real jihadist who wants to see a return of the caliphate is going to look at what we did as a model for how to establish God's kingdom on earth. And we can do this without winning over popular support. That's going to be the crux of the argument between the two of them.
And as you sit here now watching their debate over that, which strikes you as having more salience and a more receptive audience in the sort of jihadist world?
I think it's still split because ISIS still has its territory. It's not out of the game yet. And I think it's one reason why they carried out these spectacular string of attacks over Ramadan, was to grab the attention of the Muslim world and to show the jihadist community that we are here and we are delivering in a big way that Al-Qaeda could never dream of. Al-Qaeda, which pretends to be engaged in the global jihad, but we're actually making good on it. But Al-Qaeda also has a success story to tell. It has made gains in Yemen on the ground, and it's made gains inside of Syria on the ground as well. So I think in the jihadist mind, opinion is still split because the fight's not over yet.
So one of the weird things about the caliphate, and I assume one of the reasons that Al-Qaeda has been reticent about ever declaring it itself, is that it's supposed to be a continuing institution, right? I mean, it existed throughout, correct me if I'm wrong about this, but throughout Islamic history until Ataturk abolished it, right? Mm-hmm. And there's something that seems sort of inadequate about establishing a caliphate that lasts for a couple years and then gets stomped by a boot like a bug. Is there any risk of discontinuity in a declared caliphate? I mean, if you declare yourself the caliph and then you get, you know, swept away with a broom, what happens to the caliphate?
So what happens to it if it has no more land, or what happens to it if the caliph gets knocked off?
Well, I mean, I suppose you've already answered the first question, right? But if you can go into sort of hibernating, disappearing act, caliphate land. But if your caliph is caught or captured or killed, and there's no obvious line of succession, and there's no land,
right?
Things get kind of difficult.
There will always be a successor, because it is not supposed to be dynastic. Now, in Islamic history, it ends up many times being dynastic, but in theory, it's not supposed to be. It's supposed to be an elected institution chosen by the notables. In ISIS's case, that would be their consultative council, 9 or 11 members, depending. They will make the decision about who the next caliph is going to be. Their trouble is going to be that the folks that they have on the bench, most of them do not have the qualifications that the current incumbent has. He has a sterling lineage, family lineage, not just descended from Muhammad's tribe, which is a prerequisite for Sunnis, but directly descended from Muhammad himself, which he has, and his those around him have argued, makes him uniquely qualified for reestablishing the caliphate. There's no one I can see in his orbit that has that lineage. Perhaps they will produce it later, but it's a problem. No one also has his religious credentials. He is an honest-to-God PhD scholar of the Quran, which gives him added legitimacy in the eyes of ISIS and its followers.
And he's a good soccer player.
And he's a hell of a soccer player as well. So no one's going to have that trifecta.
So what... they've done a pretty good job of shielding him from drone strikes, from, you know, U.S. intelligence, from the Iraqi government. I assume eventually his luck will run out. The half-life of people in the head of that organization is, he's done better than any of the others, but it's not that long. When we last talked about this at the time that you wrote your article, your view was ISIS would suffer from his loss more than Al-Qaeda suffers from, say, the loss of Zawahiri.
Right.
But in the context of a descendant, ISIS in decline, how much bigger a problem is that?
Would be a huge problem. Because not only do they lose a man with his credentials, they also lose a savvy politician. This is the guy who was able to bridge the gap between the two main factions inside of ISIS, the Arab foreign fighters and the local Iraqis. And the Iraqis used to be on the bottom in the pecking order, and now they're on the top. But it was him that was able to bridge that divide. And the people that replace him, the person that replaces him, may not be as competent a politician as he is. And couple that with a caliphate in rapid decline, they are going to have a double crisis of legitimacy because they will have lost their head of state and the state.
So you're describing a pretty tough environment for them right now. Loss of land, not a good succession strategy in the event, or not a particularly strong one in the event that the leader is killed or captured. Serious resource competition, again, from a once highly diminished Al-Qaeda. Mm-hmm. What's the adaptation strategy that we can expect from them on the theory that they've been a pretty dynamic organization that has snatched, if not quite victory, certainly viability from the jaws of defeat in
right.
the past?
Right.
What should we look for the next iteration of ISIS to look like?
They go to ground again. They are very good at biding their time and preparing the battlefield for the next go around. I'm mindful of the fact that when they were defeated as an insurgency by 2009, they spent the next 3 years assassinating hundreds of members of the Awakening Councils who had gone against them in Iraq, patiently eliminating anyone who could be a potential rival when they were able to rise up again after the Americans left. So they were quietly preparing, and it's what they would do again if they're defeated in Syria and Iraq. They have extensive networks, even more extensive now than the first time around. And they now have an international network that they can draw on too. So they can try to build states in other areas as well. And unfortunately, in the Middle East and North Africa, there's just so many places for them to go right now.
Will McCants, thank you very much for joining us.
My pleasure.
The Lawfare Podcast is produced in cooperation with the Brookings Institution. Our music is performed by Sophia Yan. As always, please spread the word and promote the Lawfare Podcast via your social networks on Twitter, Facebook, email, and in any way you can. Thanks for listening.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house, with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. WarbyParker.com/covered.